It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse, joins us to give us his take on the biggest issues facing Congress.
First, health care and a tax overhaul are still on the table in the U.S. Senate. The nominee for the new head of the Drug Enforcement Agency is out, and Steve Bannon is warning Senate Republicans that they could face primary challenges.
Those are just a few items in a busy week in Washington. Paul Singer joins us now for a look at the latest. He's Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Well, good. Now, let's start with this healthcare story that went from big news to nothing, it looks like now. A bipartisan duo of senators, Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, Republican and Democrat, they said, hey, we got this compromise. We'll bring back these subsidy payments that the president got rid of, give the states more flexibility. People seemed happy. The president seemed happy. Now everybody hates the plan. What's going on?
Well, I don't know. What time is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's
really
been today.
It's been all over the place today. At one point, in a 24-hour period, basically, both, you know, the president seemed enthusiastic, and then he seemed unenthusiastic this morning, and then the Republican leadership seemed enthusiastic yesterday, and then they seemed unenthusiastic today. Then a little while ago, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was at the podium, seeming unenthusiastic, but not saying actually no, saying, well, you know, the president wants, you know, to tighten it up a little bit, maybe make some fixes. I honestly have no idea what's going on. I say that as somebody who spent most of the day watching this thing. It is very, very clear that everybody in Washington is concerned, including, I think, the president, about what happens if the subsidy payments collapse and therefore premiums increase dramatically for low-income people trying to get insurance on the markets. But they don't seem to yet have an answer because the president also doesn't want to be seen just giving, as he says, a bailout to insurance companies. Now, what Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander will say is this is not a bailout to insurance companies. This is essentially a bailout to low-income health insurance consumers. But, we don't know at any given moment what the president's mood on this is going to be. So we don't know at this point whether this is a real thing or not.
Now, assuming the status quo at this second Central Time stays as it is, the subsidy payments that President Trump canceled, they don't come back. Premiums
right.
do go up. It seems like some of the talk now is who gets blamed. President says it's just showing more failure of Obamacare. Democrats are saying this is showing that you're sabotaging Obamacare. If it stays this way until election 2018, is this something they're still going to be battling over then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Let's assume status quo at this moment that this thing does not pass and the subsidy payments do end. If, in fact, people begin to see significant price increases in their insurance early next year, that will be news, and people will be complaining about that. And it doesn't matter who you want to blame. The fact of the matter is that if people start to see significant price spikes, it will not be good for the president and the Republicans in Congress who control both Congress and the White House. It's the same as gas prices. You know, we always talk about this. Gas prices go up and down, essentially independent, completely independent of anything the president can do, and yet the president always gets blamed when gas goes to $4 a gallon.
And people have been pointing out, I think you were one of the people I'm thinking of here, Paul, that this seems to be a trend with President Trump. He takes an action that puts something that some people want in peril, whether it's these subsidies or the on immigration, the deferred action for childhood arrival recipients. He makes a change and then basically kind of throws the ball into Congress's court saying, this is going to break now unless you fix it. Is this an intentional tactic on the president's part, do you think?
I think so. I mean, again, hard to read the tea leaves of the guy, but it is clear that there are things he wants to say he has done, and he wants to say he's repealed and replaced Obamacare. He wants to say he's broken gotten out of the Iran deal. He wants to be able to say, he has, for instance, gotten the U.S. out of the Paris climate talks. You know, he wants to be able to say he's redone NAFTA. But a lot of those things are not really done. What he does is he kind of opens the can, but he doesn't actually sort of dump the beans on the floor. So that's the next question, is what do we do now? And he basically hands it all to Congress. The thing that is sort of interesting about this is that, and I think that I said on Twitter a couple of days ago, that, you know, Congress at the moment is the least competent branch of government. They can't legislate on much. So now the president is just adding to the pile of things they're supposed to be legislating on. They've got to do something on DACA. They've got to do something on the Iran deal. They've got to do something on these health insurance subsidies. It's like the number of things they've got to do something on is getting longer and longer, while Congress is getting no more competent to actually do any of it.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We have a lot of cans of beans to dump on the floor here, Paul. Let's move on to a tax overhaul. Republicans working on this. Step one, passing a budget, apparently, and then that would open the door to a tax system overhaul. How are they doing at this point?
Well, again, what time is it? At the moment, what the Senate appears to be succeeding in doing is lining up the votes to pass this budget outline. Budget outline is step one. It is the thing that basically says, yes, you've got $1 trillion to spend on this stuff, and yes, you can do it with only 50 votes. You don't need any Democrats. They have to pass that thing first, that outline first. And it looks like they've got the votes they need to do that at the end of this week. That is only step one. The remaining steps are no easier, because then you have to get to a point where you actually draft a tax bill. You actually have to provide in that bill to cut taxes for a lot of people, but you're going to increase taxes on other people. This is the dirty little secret here. Not everybody gets a tax cut. And the people who don't get a tax cut and see their taxes actually increase are going to be mad about that. So then you have to see, can I pass this bill with a lot of people mad? And then, of course, you have the sort of more philosophical question about, can you really pass a tax bill that essentially says it doesn't matter if it increases the deficit by $1 trillion, because the economy is going to grow so fast and so vigorously over the next few years that it'll wipe out all that deficit. That's basically the gamble the Republicans are preparing themselves for, and there may be some people who balk at that in the Congress.
A lot of people are watching what Senate Republicans do on the issues we've talked about so far. One of those people is a fellow named Steve Bannon. You reported on him this week, White House strategist, former White House strategist. He spoke to conservatives this week, and he had a message for Senate Republicans.
All of you folks that are so concerned that you're going to get primaried and defeated, you know, there's time for mea culpa. You can come to a stick and condemn Senator Corker. And you can come to a stick, a microphone, and you can say, I am not going to vote for Mitch McConnell for majority leader.
So you reported on this, Paul, more on Steve Bannon's message for those Senate Republicans.
You know, the funny thing about that Bannon quote, which I love so much, is that, you know, here is the consummate outsider. We're coming for you. We're coming for you. We're bringing the pitchforks. We're coming for you. But in so doing, he says you can come to the stick, which is insider talk. That is actually the language we use, sticks and stills. It means the microphones and cameras will be able to come to the event, but not all of the reporters and not all of the video people. Again, sticks and stills. So here's the consummate outsider fight, right? But cast by a consummate insider. It's kind of bizarre. But, yeah, this is a guy who was the president's right-hand man, that is the Republican president of the United States, basically declaring war on the Republican leadership in the U.S. Congress and saying that if you are refusing to denounce Mitch McConnell, we are going to primary you and we're going to try and kick you out of the Senate. It's stunning.
Is this year ripe, or next year, I guess, ripe for successful Republican primaries? Because, you know, there are fellas named Cantor and other big names who were successfully primaried out of their Republican congressional seats. Then there's a fella named Paul Ryan. There was a lot of excitement about his primary challenger last year. Didn't lose a lot of sleep over that, I don't think. What do you see happening next year?
You know, The fact of the matter is that all politics is still local, and so each one of these races is distinct. The Eric Cantor race is a very different animal. That was blindsiding everybody, with the exception of my next-door neighbor down in Culpeper, Virginia, who told me it was coming, and I wasn't paying any attention, because he had been to, like, some local county political convention where Cantor's people got, you know, kicked out of the room or something. Every one of these is local. Now, how strong is the candidate that Bannon is backing? Some of these candidates might be strong. Some of them might be a little freaky. You know, we have already seen in Alabama that the Bannon-backed candidate, Roy Moore, beat the McConnell and Trump-backed candidate, a guy named Luther Strange, an incumbent senator, in a Republican primary. So, we think it's possible. I mean, clearly, Roy Moore has shown it's possible that these pitchfork-type insurgent Republicans can unseat the incumbents. But we also don't know in each state how good the candidate's going to be. We don't know how good the environment's going to be, and we don't know ultimately what Trump's brand is going to be either. Given, as we were talking about earlier, you know, how good's the economy, how your job's improved, is your insurance going up, stuff like that.
We're talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the top stories in a busy week of national news.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see primary challenges to Republican senators in the 2018 elections? And do you think there should be a bipartisan compromise on health care in the U.S. Senate? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation right now with Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the top stories in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the top story in national politics today? I had 8 or 9 to choose from. I'm interested to see what you are watching right now out of Congress, out of the White House, in the courts, for that matter. And are you looking for some kind of bipartisan reform of health care, changes to the Affordable Care Act, tax reform? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, what I thought at one point was going to be our lead story today, we had a nominee for the Drug Enforcement Agency, Congressman Tom Marino. He withdrew from that nomination after his connections with the drug industry were profiled in a 60 Minutes Washington Post report. What in this report scotched the deal for him?
Well, the basic gist of it is that the congressman supported a piece of legislation. I don't know the details of it completely, but the long and the short of it is the legislation made it easier for people to prescribe opioid prescriptions, and it made it harder for states to intervene, basically, and cut down on the number of opioids being sold in their state. Well, the report from the Washington Post and I believe it was 60 Minutes, right? There's a whistleblower at the DEA who said, essentially, we told everybody all along that this legislation was going to flood the market with opioids and make it a lot harder for us to stop opioid addiction. And lo and behold, that is what has happened. And Congressman Marino should have known better, basically, is the argument, and did know better and chose to ignore it because he was being pressured and funded by lobbyists for the drug industry that make this stuff. And it was a pretty damning report. A damning report, not necessarily for a regular member of Congress, although it would certainly raise some questions about what the member of Congress was doing, but a damning report really for somebody who's supposed to be the drug czar responsible for stopping opioid addiction. So it was pretty clear once this thing came out and President Trump was asked about it and said, we're looking into it. The time clock on the Marino nomination at that point began to count down, and then early in the morning, whatever day it was, a couple of days ago, he withdrew.
And we've seen some withdrawals of nominations and some people who did go into key positions in the administration, lots of them, and leave. Does this seem like more than usual this far, less than a year into an administration?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're already through a couple communications directors and a chief of staff. There is the HHS secretary had to step down, Tom Price. because he was found to be using charter flights, which were not illegal, but were sort of bad optics, as we say here in Washington. There is some conversation that the president has not severed ties with Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, largely because they don't want it to look like there is some kind of chaos going on in the White House. And you know, giant turnover. Steve Bannon, of course, was a headline when he left, was the senior strategist in the White House. So, you know, there has this has been an unusually unsettled White House, I think is the fair way to put that. I don't lay blame for that necessarily. I don't argue that it's necessarily even bad. That's not my job. But it definitely has been more of a revolving door than you normally see at the White House at this stage.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the big stories in national politics. Here's one that's been breaking over the last day or so. A story, it started a couple weeks ago now. Four U.S. soldiers killed in Niger. They were advisors there. A question at a press conference yesterday to the president about his response. He says he'll be calling them, getting in touch. No other presidents before had done that. Let's start at that point, because a lot of people raised red flags with that.
Yeah, this is part of the Trump's unforced error strategy. I mean, he has this odd habit of doing and saying things that start fires that are really unnecessary. And there was absolutely no reason for him to say this, that other presidents had not reached out. I'm doing a better job reaching out to these military members than others. All he had to say was, you know, I'm terribly sad about this tragic event. I am reaching out to those families. I haven't reached out to them yet because of, you know, some issues about identifying who they are, whatever you want to say, and then just move on. But instead, he adds this little coda that, Obama didn't call everybody. And the Obama people, of course, went nuts, and everyone else has, you know, now indicated that Obama reached out to most of these people, I think through either phone or the rest of them by letters. And then Trump adds to the fire by saying, oh, yeah, we'll talk to General Kelly. That's his chief of staff, whose son died in combat. Well, why are you dragging General Kelly's son into this thing? The guy was a hero. General Kelly himself was a hero. It just goes off the rails. And then, of course, there's this bizarre episode where the president then calls one of these families and, depending on whose interpretation you believe, says something that the family takes offense to. If it is true, what the president was saying to them is, well, you know, he knew what he was signing up for, which is a little bit callous. Now, the president disputes having said that, sort of. He then goes on Twitter and says, by the way, the odd fact here is that when the president was talking to the family, there was a Democratic congresswoman in the car because they were pals. So the Democratic congresswoman is the one who reports Trump's comments. So now Trump is on Twitter attacking the Democratic congresswoman for saying that's not what I said, and more unforced errors coming. I've got proof. Well, now what? Are we going to get into one of these questions like, are there tapes? I mean, it just becomes this carnival of errors.
And the Washington Post called Gold Star families with service members who had passed away. One of them reported that the president, a father of a soldier who fell in Afghanistan, President Trump had offered, has said he'd send him $25,000 and sort of fundraiser for him, which the father says has not happened yet. So, I mean, unprecedented is an easy word to throw around. This is the kind of thing we haven't talked about before.
Right, and I've got no evidence on that.
Right, this is a father's statement to the Post,
right?
Yeah.
But it sounds a lot like Donald Trump. You know, there have been news reports. You know, David Fahrenthold over at the Post has been doing this for a couple of years now, tracking all of the times when Donald Trump said, I'm making a donation, and then doesn't make a donation. So I would be fascinated to see if that turns out to be true. I can't verify it. But, yeah, again, I will say this, which I hope is not seen as a casting judgment on the president, which is not my job. He has struggled with this empathy thing. He has struggled with the ability to figure out how to properly show empathy and grief with the fallen. It has not come natural to him, and it is continuing to be a headache for him and his press people.
One more story I want to get to before we run out of time. Some new info out, a draft that former FBI Director James Comey had written, a letter that would exonerate to Hillary Clinton over the email issues, but written apparently before the investigation was complete. What kind of responses have we seen to this?
Well, two different responses, which would not surprise you. Democrats and some people in the FBI say you should not be surprised by this. It was an investigation that had been ongoing. They were in the process of wrapping it up. It was pretty clear as they were getting down to the end that they really had not found a criminal activity. And the interview with Hillary Clinton was kind of a capstone, and so they knew pretty much already where this was going. So they were working on a draft. And the emails that the FBI has released do not show any of the text of the draft. They only show that the emails were circulating with kind of the subject line, hey, what do you think about this draft? The Republicans have a very different take on this, and you'll see this played out on Fox News and then some of the president's tweets, which is that this proves that Comey was not trying to actually investigate Clinton's email. It proves that Comey was trying to make this issue go away, so much so that he was drawing conclusions before the investigation was over and already trying to exonerate Hillary Clinton. Now, having not seen the contents of any of these statements, any of these drafts, who knows? And there will always be these two different sides. But at the moment, what we know is that they were working on, the only facts we have so far is they were working on or discussing a draft of the statement a couple months before they interviewed Hillary Clinton. We don't know what that statement said, and we don't know how far along they were in the investigation at that time.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks for taking on this whirlwind tour through a busy week.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Man, I'm going to start charging you by the topic.
That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, joining us for our weekly roundup of the top news in national politics. President Trump signed an executive order last week to end payments that help millions of lower-income Americans afford coverage under Obamacare. Analysts say this move will likely destabilize the Affordable Care Act insurance marketplaces.
A bipartisan health care deal was reached on Tuesday that would continue these cost-sharing reduction payments for 2 years, but it already looks like that plan isn't going anywhere.
Ron Kind is the U.S. representative for Wisconsin's 3rd District from La Crosse, and he joins us now to comment on that and other issues facing Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Congressman Kind? If you're in the 3rd District, what priorities would you like to see him bring to Congress? And what do you want to see from Congress when it comes to health care and the tax system? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
Representative Kind, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a beautiful fall day out there. Hopefully people are getting a chance to enjoy this great fall-like weather. I love this time of year, the changing of the seasons, the colors, bow hunting, football. I mean, what's not to like? It's great to be here.
And there's a lot going on, and I want to start with health care right now. President Trump just opted to use an executive order to stop cost-sharing reduction payments. How do you see that decision affecting health care for Americans on Obamacare?
Well, if his intent is to create incredible amount of confusion and chaos, this is a good way to do it. And this cost-sharing reduction payments are meant to keep health care affordable for all Americans. And by doing it, he's going to increase the number of uninsured, increase premium prices, and ironically, increase the cost to the federal government, because the premium tax credits will only go up if these insurance plans become more expensive. I don't know if he realizes that or not, but at some point, we've got to depoliticize the healthcare system, recognize what's working, fix what isn't, and focus on healthcare costs, what we can do working together to bring it down to make it more affordable for all Americans. That is where Congress should be focusing our attention.
And you use the phrase working together to do some of the things you were talking about, and we did see a bipartisan deal from Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican, from Tennessee, and Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington. That seems as though that deal right now to extend those cost-sharing subsidies has,
life has support.
Fizzled out, right? The president has been back and forth of his approval and support for that. It looks as, I mean, it could still evolve, but it looks as though, as you said, on life support now. What did you think of that deal?
Well, I think this, again, shows a lack of clear direction from this president and what he wants to ultimately accomplish. He does know what he can't do, and that's the repeal and replace that he's been calling for, which has failed because it was bad policy, and now he's looking to lash out. But many of us were hopeful that this bipartisan agreement in the Senate would get some traction, and we'd be able to do some short-term insurance market stabilization, making sure that the insurance plans know what the rules are over the next couple of years to settle things down while we look at other fixes that clearly have to be made in the healthcare system so it's, again, working for all Americans. And our North Star in all of this, Veronica, needs to be making sure that all Americans have access to affordable, quality healthcare in their life and stop using this as a political ping-pong ball back and forth, only creating anxiety in a lot of people's lives.
Republicans who have been opposed to this deal have said, in essence, that Obamacare wasn't working to begin with and that to throw money at it to stabilize it was the wrong thing to do for the wrong reason. What do you say to that critique?
Well, it wasn't perfect, but there were a lot of things that were working well with it. In fact, we had the most dramatic decline of the uninsured rate since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid back in the mid-1960s. Healthcare costs per capita is at a 50-year low. If you're an employee getting healthcare through your employer-sponsored plans, things are working pretty well for you right now. But there are clearly things that we need to fix. If you're an individual in the small group market without getting any help, you're getting hammered right now. And that's 5, 6% of the nation's population. You would think that Congress would get together to find some solutions for that segment of the population. And one of the big cost drivers that we see today in the healthcare system is prescription drug prices. And you would think Congress would be having hearings on it, discussions, steps that we can take to make drug prices more affordable for all Americans, but nothing is being done on this front. So there are clearly some answers to be had if people are willing to just disarm and start working together on it.
Do you see that happening? Do you see a bipartisan future for fixing health care, even though perhaps this one on the table today doesn't work?
I think it's crucial. It's necessary. And I also think that chaos doesn't work for any party or for any individual, from the president on down. And the more this is being used as a political football, the more chaos and uncertainty is created. And it's only going to drive up costs. It's only going to increase the number of uninsured. And we're really playing with people's lives by doing this. So at some point, Congress needs to grow up and just start focusing on the problems that do exist and see if we can get something done on behalf of the American people again.
We're talking right now with Representative Ron Kind, representing Wisconsin's 3rd District, which includes La Crosse. And leaving healthcare for the moment, let's talk about the next big item on the agenda, which is tax reform. What have you seen in Congress regarding tax reform so far? And what are you looking for?
Well, I'm on the committee with jurisdiction. It's been 31 years since we've had a serious run at the federal tax code, long overdue. I mean, it's a complicated mess. It's left us less competitive, unfair in many ways. It's riddled full of special interest tax loopholes that have been included throughout the years. So I'm all for taking a serious run at it. But I'm not buying into more trickle-down economics tax cuts at the top, expecting that to lift everyone else. We've tried that in the past. We've got growing income inequality in this country right now. That would only exacerbate it. And we need to do this in a fiscally responsible manner, meaning not blowing up budget deficits again, and finding offsets within the tax code to help pay for simplification and rate reduction. Otherwise, the next thing on the list is going to be deep cuts to Medicare and Social Security if they start running up huge budget deficits with just straight tax cuts. So it's important to do, but we need to do it the right way, not the wrong way, and do it in a fiscally responsible manner.
And the bill is said to, down the road, would include a big corporate tax reduction. Do you agree with that tax cut?
There's been a lot of focus at the corporate rate, which is about 35%. And what's understated is the effective rate, what corporations are actually paying, which is closer to 16, 17, 18%. Some corporations are getting tax rebates, like GE and some of the big Fortune 500. So, I think it's so much the rate, but it's the complexity and it's the loopholes that exist in it. And if there's a way that we can try to simplify it and streamline it to make our companies, large and small, more competitive globally, I think it's worth an effort. But again, let's not be fooled by the larger numbers out there. We have to see what's actually being paid and what the effect is.
What about the argument that lowering the tax rate would boost the economy and that would offset any losses?
Man, from your lips to my ears, if it were only so, but there's just no economic history or data to back that up. Economic growth isn't going to pay for the massive tax cuts. We've seen that over and over again, and yet many of my Republican colleagues are hanging their hat on that proposition. All we need is tax reform or cuts. It's going to lead to an explosion of economic growth and additional revenue that will pay for it. And there's nothing in past history that points that that, in fact, will happen. So again, that gets me back into that category. Let's be fiscally responsible and smart if we do this. Find loopholes that we can shut down to pay for the rate reduction, but let's not leave a legacy of debt for our children and grandchildren.
I want to take a caller on the topic right now. Let's go to Dwayne in Madison. Dwayne, hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Not bad. What do you think?
I'm all for simplified taxes. I go back to like 1966. I got in the mail when I first started paying taxes. It was a little form, no bigger than what they used to call a punch card. And then you'd fill in your information and send it back. And that was all there was to it. I don't know why we can't simplify the tax form and go to just a postcard type, and they've advertised this. I really like that idea. I also like another idea, and that is a flat tax for everybody. Every man, woman that works in this country is pay a flat 5%, 10% tax, whatever it would take. And there are no loopholes and no exemptions, except a certain couple that a few exemptions that might really be needed. But otherwise, everybody pays their fair share. If you make $100,000, you pay, $10,000 or whatever the case might be.
Dwayne, thanks a lot. Dwayne, looking for simplification of the tax code. Sounds like somewhat you're looking for as well.
I agree with Dwayne. If we can simplify it, it's one of the major sources of concern I hear from small business owners throughout the state is the complexity of the code, the compliance costs, the inefficiency that's wasted, and the resources in that, and if we could get there. But I've also found attractive flat tax proposals, but I'm also a believer in maintaining progressivity in the tax code. That way, if you're earning more, more is expected of you. And if you're earning less, you're not going to be contributing as much of a proportion of your income. So if there's a way of melding those two ideas, we might have something that we can work on. But again, I hear so much frustration given the complexity. But the reality is close to 70% of the tax filers are doing 1040 EZ forms. Those are one-page forms that they're able to fill out, which isn't all that complicated, and that's the vast majority of Americans today.
Thank you for that call, Dwayne. And let's take another call now. We've got Ray joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Ray.
Hi. After the Las Vegas killings, I was surprised when I called your office and they told me that you were not in support of banning bump stocks, which turn weapons into automatic weapons. I would like to hear your rationale for that.
Well, Ray, I apologize if you got false information from someone in my office, but I came out immediately saying this needs to be banned, preferably through legislation and not through regulation. I think the Republican leadership wants to do this through regulation. But these bump stocks, and I didn't know they were even on the market, but they convert semi-automatics into automatics. And the automatic weapons are already banned in this country. So, yeah, of course we need to do that. And I'd prefer to do it through legislation. And in fact, Ray, you may have heard me also renew my call for a bipartisan commission to study gun violence and come up with some reasonable steps we can take to reduce that. That's going to have an impact on our communities at home while still being respectful of Second Amendment rights. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time here. I'm a kid who grew up in western Wisconsin. I love to hunt and fish. I own multiple guns myself, and I think there's a way of being able to enhance gun safety while still being respectful of Second Amendment rights. So I apologize if you are misinformed on that issue.
And Ray, thank you for that call. And we're talking right now to U.S. Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What priorities do you think Congress should have at this point? What kind of tax changes, tax reform would you like to see? What about health care? Do you see room for bipartisan cooperation? What's important in Wisconsin, in your district, if you are in the 3rd District? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Right now, we're picking up our discussion with U.S. Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin's 3rd District, which includes La Crosse.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the representative? What should the priorities be in Congress? What are you hoping comes out of the big debates that are going on right now on things like Iran, healthcare, taxes? call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
And before we get back to our callers, I want to ask you about Foxconn. Mm. Recently, Wisconsin, as you know, passed an incentive package to bring the Taiwanese company to Wisconsin. The package said to be the largest U.S. subsidy ever given to a foreign corporation. Was this, do you think, the right move to boost Wisconsin's economy and its manufacturing sector?
You know, I wasn't involved in the intimate details of it, but I've had great trepidation what I've heard from a $3 billion commitment to a company in an industry that is changing by the month, let alone what it's going to look like in 25 years. I hope they have clawback provisions in it in case Foxconn doesn't hit their marks. They've pulled up short in many similar instances here in America and overseas. And it is a big bet that could jeopardize the investments we have to make in the future of our state for many years to come. And I also find it curious that they want to locate this down close to the Illinois border. I mean, if this was about Wisconsin jobs, there were plenty of locations more centrally located in the state that would have guaranteed Wisconsin jobs being created than, again, having them so close to Illinois.
What kind of location are you thinking of?
I'm thinking, hey, the 3rd Congressional District up in Stevens Point or Wausau and that area. That's a great place, great universities, technical schools for job training skills and that, not too far from Madison even, a little bit north. But, hey, and this is a problem, a trend that we're seeing throughout the country is these bidding wards that are starting, bringing companies into your state and willing to sacrifice the tax base. With Foxconn, it's tax rebates that they'll be entitled to for many, many years to come. And I hope that the best case analysis proves accurate, that this is going to spur a lot more job creation and spin-off opportunities. But again, it's a very volatile industry that we're playing with Foxconn, and it is changing very rapidly. So anyone to place a quarter of a century bet of that magnitude, $3 billion, I'm just thinking, yikes.
All right, let's go back to our phone calls. Now we've got Eric joining us next in Beloit. Eric, hi.
Hi. Great topics, great ideas to discuss. I want to go back even farther to basics, and the area that I have a concern is gerrymandering and how it affects all of these other topics. As it is, you know, either party, as they get to power, can build districts that are so safe that they're unassailable, in a sense. You know, one party can dominate a district or maybe even control an election without having, you know, representation in a way that's evenly distributed. I'd like to be able to have that be nonpartisan, so that we get districts that are competitive, that people have to represent, you know, not just a party or an ideology, but rather, you know, the district as a whole. So we become more competitive. We get people moving to the center instead of to the extremes.
Eric, thank you so much for that call. And Representative Kine, a big court case before the U.S. Supreme Court right now, looking at Wisconsin's redistricting. What is your take on this?
Yeah, just argued last week, so we're holding our breath. But I agree with Eric. I think we need to let the people choose the representatives and not the representatives choosing the voters in the districts that they represent. I think that is so wrong and contrary to democracy. I've consistently sponsored legislation at the federal level that would incent states to create nonpartisan commissions to draw the political boundaries. Other states have done it, Iowa, Washington, California. It's working fine for them. And it brings credibility back into our democratic process so people don't feel that their votes are disenfranchised. And that's my greatest fear with all this gerrymandering is people are going to drop out if they think, what's the point of participating? Because the books are cooked already. And we can certainly start by leading by example here in Wisconsin. So I renew my call for Governor Walker and the legislature to embrace the nonpartisan commission proposal. I know it's tough for them to do it since they're in complete control, but and both parties have been equally guilty on this front. But I think it's the right thing to do to restore some integrity in Wisconsin politics again.
I was going to ask you, so whenever we discuss this on the show, it comes up, well, this is what Democrats in Wisconsin did 10 years ago. Are you willing to give the chance up when Democrats are in power?
Yeah, we have to. You know, both parties need to link arms and jump into the icy waters together and trust the American people. I'm a representative of one of the last true swing districts that is in this country. You know, it's about a one-third, one-third, one-third district with one-third independents in it, too. And that's why it's competitive. And I'd like to see more of those districts because of that, I was ranked the 11th most independent member of the entire U.S. Congress, 11 out of 435, because I think that's what the people who I represent want me to be in Washington, trying to find some common ground, trying to find a bipartisan path forward, and not allowing the extremes on either side to try to drive the agenda, or we're just going to end up with more gridlock.
Go back to our callers, and thank you for that call. We go to Mitchell in Keeler. Mitchell, hello.
Hey, how you doing? I have a quick question on, I know Trump likes to go to these rallies full of blue-collar workers and talk about the estate tax and about how he wants to repeal it and stuff like that. So I was kind of wanted to see your view on where you stand there.
Yeah, I don't think it should be repealed. I think the exemptions are incredibly generous already, close to $11 million for a married couple. Roughly 0.2% of the estates are even affected today. And I have a hard time representing an agriculture district, finding these iconic farmers that are impacted by the estate tax. So there are better ways of reforming the code rather than, again, huge breaks at the top. And we're talking about the next generation inheriting a mountain of wealth and none of that being taxed at all. And a lot of what's accumulated in estates are unrealized capital gains that are never taxed as long as they go unrealized. So there's more complexity to this subject than what the other side might lead you to believe.
Mitchell, thank you for that call. And Representative Kind, another story in the news. We've been talking a little bit, not just this week, but throughout the past several years, the opioid crisis in Wisconsin and beyond. Wisconsin has been struck especially hard. We're not alone in that. But is there something that you feel Congress could and should be doing to help?
Yeah, you know, this is an all-hands-on-deck moment, Veronica, and we need strong partnerships at the federal, state, local level and working with private organizations as well. Listen, I'm a former prosecutor and special prosecutor. I handled a lot of drug cases in my former life, and I haven't met one person in law enforcement that believes we can deal with this just through the criminal justice system. This has to be a public health response if we're going to get out ahead of this curve, and it's something that's ravaging all of our communities throughout the country. It's especially potent in rural areas that I represent, too, and they certainly need more resources. We need to maintain mental health services. That's something that President Trump is trying to roll back on the Affordable Care Act, which I think would lead to an explosion of the opioid crisis rather than helping to solve it.
Let's take another caller. Now we've got Travis joining us in Algonquin. Hi, Travis.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm just calling to respond a little bit. I was curious more about the independent investigation about weapon violence the congressman suggested. If I recollect correctly, isn't the WHO kind of not allowed to do anything like that? And I was wondering, if I'm recollecting correctly, if the congressman has any thoughts about some kind of independent investigation set up from something like that.
And Travis, thank you. And I think you're talking about CDC research.
Yeah, exactly. And Travis, you know, this is frustrating because there are no hearings going on in Congress about this whatsoever. Everyone's ducking low. Research funding on gun violence is explicitly prohibited right now under federal law. And that's why I think a nonpartisan commission or a bipartisan commission to study this makes sense. We've got to have the conversation. And it needs to be more than just feel-good measures, something that actually is going to make an impact in enhancing the safety of our communities and our lives. And what's understated is the amount of suicide by gun, including veterans. And that's something that deserves more attention as well.
And Representative Kind, as we start to wrap up here, I wonder what you think about prospects for bipartisanship moving forward. When President Obama was in office, the Republican agenda was to obstruct until their party was in power. They have that now, so the tables are turned. Do you like seeing bipartisanship and President Trump in this case, reaching out to members of the Democratic Party? What do you want to see from?
Well, we desperately need it. It's the only way things are going to get done. There's some serious issues we need to address, and as long as it remains so polarized, hyper-partisan, nothing's going to get done. And it's going to lead to growing disenchantment from the American people with their democratic system. So, and I just want to, in conclusion, just tell you guys to hang on. I know there's been an assault on the freedom of the press and the First Amendment, but we're celebrating the 100th anniversary now of Wisconsin Public Radio, the 50th anniversary of the Public Broadcasting Act being signed into law. It's one of the bedrocks of our democracy is the ability of a free and fair press to be critical of their elected officials and hold us to task and ask us tough questions and that. And I'm afraid people are becoming disenchanted.
And we leave it there. Representative Kind, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin's 3rd District on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We missed it, but yesterday was Payback a Friend Day.
The idea is that you're supposed to think about someone you owe something to, money probably, and maybe something else, and pay them back.
And this tradition goes back to medieval Europe, and no, actually it was a publicity thing for Bank of America. They just came up with it. That said, it did seem to strike a nerve. Evidently, a lot of people think their friends owe them something. You know, they're in debt.
Well, it did spark a conversation between the two of us, Rob, right, about whether someone who shall remain nameless owed a certain someone else maybe some money for maybe a tuna melt.
A tuna melt, yeah. And the funny thing is, like, sometimes we do spot each other, you know, when we go out for,
as friends do,
usually a tuna melt. And you, it's possible that you owe me, but we never really keep track. So, I mean, I think I could claim that you owe me like 6 tuna melts and you might believe me.
Well,
and you could claim that you owe me 0 and I probably would believe you.
That's probably closer to the truth, the 0 number.
You're going with
actually,
0?
You know what? I'm
going
to go with half a tuna melt.
Okay.
I think that I owe you money for half a tuna melt.
Well, you know, we could split one. Maybe. Are they back on Friday?
You never split them. You always
every
eat
other
thing.
Week, too. That's
yeah,
true.
Every other week.
I can't just eat half a tuna melt. Who am I kidding? No,
yeah,
one.
Not me. That's for sure.
All right. Well, pay back your friends. That's the lesson here on Central Time.